Hey everybody, we're the Con Artists. We're back for another podcast episode. This time it's Scott and I talking about the uber controversial Final Fantasy 13, the first one.
Hey there, folks.
Yay, Scott! Yeah, we're going to talk about the first one only. We're not talking about Final Fantasy 13 2 or Lightning Returns.
Although maybe someday.
Yeah, someday when we play all of them. Okay, so let's start off with the characters. You've got Lightning, who's plastered over the media forever. You've got Snow at Toolbox, who wears the beanie cap.
Oh, the beanie cap.
You've got Hope, the 14-year-old boy. You have Saz, the man with the chocobo in his hair. Yes, I just said that. Yes, that really happens.
They really like promoted the heck out of that during the early promotion material. Like, this guy's got a
Exactly.
chocobo
They
in his
were
hair.
like, yeah, the little chocobo pops out and it's like, "Ee, I'm here." And you're like, "That's cool. Sure, why not?"
Is kind of cute.
It is pretty cute. I mean, I will admit it's really cute, and its symbolism is really adorable once you figure out what it's all about. Then you've got Fang. Fang is the
The best
best.
character.
And then you've got Vanille, who I think we'll get into her a little bit more later, but she really shocked me because you meet her and you're ready to hate this girl, and
I am
she just, you
100%
know,
ready to hate Vanille.
she's just all right in the end. You really don't 100% hate her in the end, so pretty shocking.
Yeah, but she's like the chipper go get 'em kind of character, at least on the surface.
Yeah, oh my goodness. And then her voice is that like really high, like I'm trying to be the Japanese voice actress,
Oh
and you're like,
yeah,
you really
that
don't need
was
to do
probably a
that.
mistake too.
Okay, so the concept of 13 is actually pretty convoluted, but I really don't want to give too much of the plot away. So for the first time, maybe the second time, I'm probably going to say that there are limited spoilers in this one, so you can listen to it without too many problems.
Yeah.
So there are these things called the Falsi. They are kind of like gods, and they are on the world that we live in. Cocoon. Cocoon is very like cyberpunk-esque.
Yeah, like futuristic looking, high tech modern, I guess you'd say. You know,
Yeah,
all
that's
the
a good
modern
description.
conveniences, that sort of thing, but sort of powered by magic almost.
Yeah, and there's like lit up highways and
They got cars, I mean, that kind of thing. Yeah.
yeah, and like light cycles and yeah, like a fusion of almost like Tron and something else. It definitely glows like Hong Kong. It's Neon Tron.
Yeah, that's a good way of, you
All
know.
right, so you got Cocoon, and so the Falsi are gods that are living on Cocoon, but they also exist on the other world that you go to later, Pulse. Pulse is it's just a 180-degree difference. Pulse is just this tribal, like wilderness filled place that is totally not like Cocoon. So you're looking at like nature versus hardcore man-made cyber structures.
Right, and like the fallacies sort of reflect that. Like the ones on Cocoon are all kind of about maintaining order and in society and so on, and the ones on Pulse are more about survival of the fittest and that sort of thing. They
Right.
don't like each other very much, which is a major feature of the setting.
Yeah, so they tend to blend more into nature on Pulse. So what happens is the Falsi, the gods, they choose the humans on Cocoon and they get turned into something called Lassie. Lassie are forced into something doing some sort of task called a focus. And the focus is very confusing because people get like a prophetic dream of some sort and then they're supposed to like figure out exactly what their focus is and complete
Yeah, you
it.
kind of got to guess what they want you to do from the picture. So, but it can often be
Right,
difficult to figure out what that
exactly.
is.
And the scary part is you're on a timer because if you don't complete your focus, you're turned into something called a Seath, which is this just giant raving monster with a human face and crystal body, and it's kind of horrifying, and you're just like, whoa. So, you just wander around for all eternity in pain and regret. Or if you complete your focus, you have the lucky privilege of being encased in crystal forever.
But apparently not in pain, so that's better.
Sure,
Basically, being turned
maybe.
into a Lassie isn't the best deal as a human.
Yes, it's not the best thing. Yeah, it's when you're picked, it's practically a death sentence. And the idea of the plot is that when you're branded as a Lassie, Cocoon with its world order, they basically just decide that you're a threat to the population and they want nothing to do with you, so they throw you on a train and they just exile you to Pulse, which they consider hell, basically.
Right, and I mean, so the general plot is that our six main characters we mentioned are all turned into Lassie like simultaneously and given a fairly broad focus to complete, And they all end up getting sent down to Cocoon. I guess you'd say four of them. You meet two others along the way that are already Lassie. But whatever, your team is six Lassie, and you got to kind of figure out what the deal is.
Yeah, so that's the idea. And that's kind of where we pick up.
Yeah, so I mean, we're not going to say too much more about the plot. Basically, go down there and you figure stuff out and explore this world that's down there that's different from what you've been told. And that's kind of the driving force of the plot.
Yeah, and our characters are very special because they actually get the same focus, which is, I think, not even possible.
Yeah, which is fairly unusual as far as Lassie go. Usually it's one guy gets a mission to do one thing, so this is pretty special. Hence why it's a driving thing. All right, so that's the overall structure. And I guess first we're going to talk about the kind of stuff that we liked in the game. The stuff.
Yeah, so shock value with Scott and I, we liked this game.
Yeah, it got pretty mixed reviews and people were very polarized by it. We ended up in the we like it camp, so we'll be telling you about the stuff we liked and, you know, some of the stuff we didn't. But overall, you know, plus on Final Fantasy XIII. And probably right at the top of that list for us is the battle system, which has been significantly revamped from previous Final Fantasies. They've been trying a lot of stuff in recent years with, like, Final Fantasy XII's Gambit system and that kind of thing. And this one changes it up some more. So, for one thing, it's real-time all the time. It's not really active time battle, although I guess it's kind of similar. But a big thing is there's no MP. You don't have to. You can cast, like, fire or whatever or cure as many times as you want in order, and there's nothing preventing you from doing that, which I really liked.
Yeah, that worked out great, seriously, because I didn't have to keep track of what the heck was going on and like, oh no, did I run out of MP?
Right, so it's I mean, your characters are supposed to be powerful, and now you don't have to manage MP or find ethers or any of that other stuff. You can just use powerful moves as much as you want. I mean, they balance them against physical. It's not like magic is necessarily stronger, but it makes for a much...
Right.
I don't know. It's a simpler system to manage that sort of thing, which I like. Another big deal is the role system. So there's several roles in the game. Commando, which is like pure damage. Ravager, which is like AoE damage and combo building. Sentinel, which is basically a tank. Medic, which is obvious. Saboteur, which is like a debuff type character. And Synergist, which is a buffing character. And you've got three party members at once, and you pick from among this set of roles, and it kind of gives you a makeup. You can have up to six of these sets of roles available to you in any given combat. So you kind of put your team together of characters, and then you pick what they're going to do. And now you hope you have the roles to react to the situations that you're going to come across in battle. It's pretty good system, actually.
Yeah, it looks like it's not going to work out the first time. And then you actually start playing it, and you start shifting the paradigms around and the roles around, and it becomes a lot of fun. And I think it was one of those things that when you first start learning it, you're like, oh, this is a piece of cake. I'm just going to keep the default three roles they gave me. This is stupid. And then in the end, you really have to think it out. You're like, oh, okay, I only have three characters. I have these combinations. What's going to do the best for me? And what's going to work out the best for this scenario, and what's the best set of paradigms to put in, and you really just don't get the opportunity to stick with one and chug along.
That's never going to work.
Yeah, eventually you're just, you know, in this boss battles, and you're flipping a mile a minute.
Right, and also, like, you know, if you think, oh, I'll just have, you know, a commando for damage, and a sentinel to be tank, and a medic to heal them, some of those enemies are never going to go down if you stick with that. Like, sometimes you got to go all commanders and ravagers. Sometimes you got to go in defense mode where no one's attacking just to get your health back up. It really does make you think about ways to change the battle.
Right. And what I liked, too, was that none of the roles really ever overpower another role. You know, you needed the medics. You're like, oh, Sentinel? Like, Sentinel's a blow-off. Like, I just sit there and soak damage. And Sentinel was pivotal for a lot of the boss battles. And I had a lot of my people, like, learn Sentinel and learn to block and learn to evade. It was critical mass.
Yeah, and another big deal in terms of overall Final Fantasy, like, you know, development here. This is the first one where I really felt like debuffs mattered in regular battles. Because most of the time, you look at your enemies in Final Fantasy, and you're like, why am I going to cast poison to that guy? I can kill him in two standard attacks. I'm not even going to bother. Finally, in this game, like, debuffs, being, you know, the saboteur role, was useful against pretty much any kind of creatures. They did a great job there.
Yeah, saboteur was critical. And it's definitely the sleeper type of role, because they're like, oh, I'm just gonna ignore Saboteur. And then, you know, I guess if you played enough Final Fantasies, you wouldn't even use them. And then if you don't build that up, you're gonna get in so much trouble later on. Seriously, you are. If you didn't push that upper limit of Saboteur, you're in big trouble.
You know, like, what am I doing wrong? The answer is, you probably need poison or slow or something to get through this.
Yeah, especially the Deshelga, Deprotectga. I mean, those are just amazing later in the game.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we may talk a little bit about the battle system again later, but other good stuff. The setting was actually a really cool setting. Like, it's obvious they took a lot of time to think out what was going to be going on, and it kind of showed.
Yeah, definitely did. As with all Final Fantasy games, it looks beautiful. Pulse in particular, it's just
Oh.
absolutely gorgeous, just breathtaking, all that nature. And I know everyone is a huge fan of Nobuo Uematsu for the music, and I think the guy who did it, Hamauzu, is the one who did the soundtrack for 13. I just thought the music was phenomenal.
Yeah, the music was really good. It fit the areas well. And like each of the areas definitely had their feel. Like, you know, Cocoon is really, everything moves fast. It's all glowing and neon and futuristic looking. And you get down to Pulse and it's just these wide, sweeping plains full of like, you know, wild creatures and cool looking plants. And it all looks gorgeous. I mean, these are all kinds of different colors. It's different from a lot of, you know, the modern gen games where it's a lot of brown. I mean, this is everything looks gorgeous. So good job for them.
Most definitely. Feeding right off of that, Scott, was a sense of culture. And you get into Cocoon, and everything moves fast, and everything's man-made, and the people move fast. Like, it's just always, the whole thing felt like New York. Like, everybody's always on the move, and everybody's got somewhere to go. And then you get to Pulse, and Pulse is kind of weird. There's no people on it. We'll be talking about that later, but I mean, we couldn't find any if there are people. But the whole setting, you get that sense that it's very tribal, that it's very communal, and you know, I really thought of it as like this mixture of gypsies, a little bit of Africa, but the naming scheme is Indian, which was awesome. I just thought that was so cool. The two characters from Pulse are Orba Yunfang and Orba de Vanille, and that was just really interesting because of the Indian nature of their name. They have the name of their tribe or their like city in front, so Erba, and then they had a different name, and then they had their given name, like Fang or Vanille. And that's a very old style Indian naming scheme. Like, my father has that name, and so he has the name of his village first, he has his father's name in the middle, and he has his given name. So it was just really neat, and it was this very subtle thing they just threw in. It was never in your face. They were like, oh, the culture of Pulse is like, they just kind of throw that in there. And did you notice?
Yeah, because there really aren't any people, but there is still, I guess we'll call it the remnants of civilization lying around. Like you get to explore some of these cities or villages and see all this stuff, and it's very cool. Like they obviously took the time to make it feel different than Cocoon, you know, by a lot.
Right, yeah,
They
definitely.
chose different ways of kind of going
Yeah,
in their
so
development.
I loved this idea, and I love the
Definitely.
way they
All
hit
right,
it.
so what else? Probably one of the biggest things in the game and the really important one, the heart of the game really, is the character development. As we mentioned, for a large part of the game, there aren't any NPCs at all to talk to. Stores are kind of like these automated terminals, so there's nobody to even buy stuff from. So you really focus on this main team of six characters. And of course, that's the make or break point for your game. Like, you put everything in that basket, either it's going to work or it isn't. And actually, I think that they did it, it worked out really well. They do these plot flashbacks to slowly build up the story of all these people and kind of like the six characters and tell you where they came from and who they are, and it's good stuff.
Right, and it was really a sense of six people being thrown together by fate. You know, I think with a lot of Final Fantasy, you've got like the kid and childhood friend and the other guy and the other girl that's bonded to this guy, and in the end they all have this like familial unit in a sense and trust each other, and this is just six people who are totally different personality-wise and come together, or like, so fate chose us to stick together, eh? I guess we're gonna stick together for survival's sake, but
Although even that isn't guaranteed at the beginning. Like, you know, they become their lessee or whatever. They're like, well, all right, see you guys later. I'm going that way.
Yeah, that's true. They just, like, take off in different directions. They sort of forced back together later on as part of the plot. Yeah, it's really not the bonding you would expect out of a team of six, and especially for Final Fantasy. And even then, certain people break off in pairs, and they bond in a special way. And in the end, I really wouldn't say everybody has bonded everyone else.
No, they're all sort of moving in the same direction, but they're still, yeah, you're right. Like, not everyone is 100% family with everyone else by the end. It's a group that's just kind of together. And that kind of shows in their, I guess, their jobs, we'll call it. Like, Saz is a civilian pilot before he gets drawn into all of this. And then Fang's the soldier, and Hope is just like a kid, like a suburban kid living in, you know, suburbia somewhere, basically equivalent to suburbia.
Right, yeah.
And these are all very different people from different backgrounds, and they do a good job of showing
cocoon,
that.
Cyberpunk suburbia. Yeah, and they do a really good job, and I felt like a lot of the characters had a real feel to them, and they change a lot over time.
Yeah, that was a really good part of it, too.
It was just really important. So, they just play to the idea of realism with a lot of care. Before I even bought the game, I just heard everyone under the sun complain about Hope. So Hope was kind of interesting. We jumped on the Final Fantasy board pretty late, and
yeah, in terms of its release, yeah, definitely.
It was just everybody ragging on Hope, and I was ready to hate this character. You know, you meet him, he's a 14-year-old angry punk, and for reasons, his mother ends up dying.
And he's understandably distraught by it. Like,
right.
It makes sense. Totally, like, destroyed. An ordinary person would probably go through this kind of stuff.
Right, especially being a 14-year-old boy, and he pegs the death of his mother on this one other character, Snow, and he just hates him, and his hatred and anger just fuels him forward. And by the end, his perspective on life, his perspective on the scenario, it changes so vastly, and he matures and, you know, in this really unique way. And that whole idea was really neat. And his mannerisms were totally 14-year-old boy-like throughout the game. It just fit.
Yeah, like, you may have been annoyed by him, but you could understand where he was coming from. So I think they did nail it on him, even if he is annoying. At the beginning, I mean, he gets better by the end. I liked him.
Right, exactly. And to your point, most of the characters are pretty hard to take in the beginning. You know, like, Lightning has zero personality, you know, to really speak of. She's like the Scrooge of the team, basically. Yeah. She's like, I'm not sticking with anyone. I hate everyone.
You're all slowing me down. Everybody. Like, get out of my way.
Yeah, gotta go. See you later. Bye. Yeah, so she just took off, and Saz is just like, woman, you crazy. Like, he just was following her around.
Yeah, he's like the straight man to, like, all this craziness, because he's probably the oldest character on the team. He's actually a father. Like, he's got a son who is kind of part of the plot at some points. I mean, he tries to be the voice of reason of this team, and he's like, what are you guys going off and doing? Like, I don't want to go get killed. I got people I got to go home to. And you're like, all right, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, that all really made sense. And the Chocobo is actually a replacement. Not, you know, not really a replacement, but it represents his son in this really adorable way. So it wasn't there as just a gimmick, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, it wasn't just, hey, look at this silly black man that has a chocobo in his fro. No, like, it's better than that,
yeah,
thankfully.
Yeah, yeah, like I said, Lightning was trained as a child to, you know, fend for herself, and she ends up opening up to Hope in one of the cutscenes where, you know, she's like, I lost my parents really young. It's kind of classic, but she had to take care of her sister. She joined the military to do that. She just became so hard, she forgot who she was. So she's, you know, trying to relearn to understand people now that she's been thrust into this situation.
Yeah, she actually had pretty good development, too. Like, by the end, she's actually opened up to some of them and is really, she feels like she's part of the team, which is good.
Right, definitely. Fang, who, in the beginning, she's kind of standoffish. She's really got a one-track mind in the beginning. She's like, I need to, you know, do this one thing and only this one thing. And she matures to kind of understand the group.
Yeah, which is remarkable. So when she first gets there, you think, oh, this is going to be the character that's, like, you know, going to be sort of aggressive about everything. But no, I mean, she ends up fitting in pretty well.
Yeah, and then we come to Vanille, Vanille is the classic anime girl. That's probably the only real description I have. The Genki girl.
Genki girl, yeah.
Let's go! Let's go on an adventure! Let's go! I'm so Genki! But, you know, you end up discovering that she has this crippling anxiety about something she did to someone else within the plot. Actually, it's two people within the plot, and she just feels this crippling guilt about what she's done, and she's masking it via her personalities, and it's genuinely sad. It really is. When her whole shtick comes out, she's devastated, and she's just willing to die. She's like, it's fine, Saz, you can just shoot me. It's fine. And I was like, wow, okay. I really didn't expect this level of development out of your character.
Yeah, really. I was kind of expecting you to be like the chipper one the whole time, and you really weren't, which is good.
Right. So it was interesting. All right. And you're going to have to help me defend Snow. He is just kind of there.
I don't know. It's really hard to defend. See, Snow is like, I'm the hero of my own story. Like, the hero always wins in the end, and I'm him, and it's gonna be great! Like, he's also kind of chipper, but, like, dude bro chipper? I don't really know how to put it. And, like, his arc is basically about realizing that he's not always the hero, and, like, people can get hurt by his actions. I just don't think he internalizes the lessons he's supposed to learn as well as the other characters, so he's a little hard to defend. He gets somewhat better.
Yeah, he gets somewhat more personable, and he digests some things, and he's kind of not as full of himself later. Like, at one part, it's pretty interesting. Hope confronts him at one point, and he's like, you're just saying it's gonna work out, but people really die, don't they? People really die. And Snow really comes to terms with the fact that he's has to deal with people being hurt because of him and what he's doing.
Right, and he kind of matures, but he kind of still keeps playing the optimism card, so.
Yeah, if anyone could probably have used some more time in the cooker, it's him.
Yeah, oh, Snow. Still, characters were pretty good.
Yeah, they were really interesting. You wanted to follow them. You wanted to know what was going to happen.
Yes, I mean, they were really the reason you were there. I mean, because the plot is there, but it's not as strong as the character development, so it's a good thing they put a lot into it. Let's see. I mean, that said, there is stuff to unlock, like, in the background almost. Like, the plot's in the foreground, the character development's in the foreground, but there is neat stuff to discover in the background of this world. So, like, when the Lassie fail their focus and turn into these, what was the term? Seeth. They leave behind, I guess, these stones, which are, it sort of tells you, hey, here was my deal, here was my focus, I didn't complete it. And you can go complete their focus for them and sort of, I guess, absolve them of their failure. But you also get to hear the story of what they were doing at the time and what the world was like for them, like when they became a Lassie. So you're looking, I get to look sort of through the history of mostly Pulse through them, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and it fit really well that it was on Pulse, because it was almost like storytelling, like word of mouth storytelling, where you had to piece together the world, you know, from these
yeah,
these
so
tiny
kind of fit the
snippets.
Tribal sort of, you know, word of mouth oral tradition kind of thing they had going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah. And some of these Seath paddles were super difficult.
Yes.
Holy cow! So if you wanted the story content, you were working for it.
Yeah, especially these things called the Analects, which are, they were like a part of the glossary that you could go read if you wanted to. And as you did some of the fairly major Seath battles, you could get these almost like scraps of historic documents that would tell you even more about the world, like poems about the world's creation or the nature of the, you know, the biggest, most important Falci. Pretty interesting stuff and very well written items, even if they were relatively short.
Yeah, I liked this a lot. It was definitely a almost like a scavenger hunt to understand the world around you. So it was a unique type of world building.
Yeah, which is especially potent because, you know, there is 13-2 and Lightning Returns. So as long as, and it all shares, I guess, a combined mythology. So it's cool that they have this stuff in here because you feel like it's going to be something that will be useful to understand later on.
Right, and if you read it, you actually feel like they actually had a mythology behind this whole thing. They really thought it out.
Yeah. I mean, and also it's sort of part of this larger shared mythology they have for a number of games. What is it? Fabula Nova Crystallis or something.
Right,
or like,
which was the whole universe
yeah,
they
like
were trying
Final
to
Fantasy
create.
Type-0 is sort of part of the same universe, so they have Falci and Lissi and that sort
of
thing.
And even I think 15 even has that universe mixed in there, because that one was originally 13 Verses, which was supposed to be this epic that tied in with 13, and the development just went on so freaking long that now it's become 15. So you know, it just turned itself into 15. But I think the idea of Etro and stuff is going to remain in there. That's the goddess Etro is what I'm saying. And I think she's going to at least be mentioned or understood that she's part of the mythology. I don't think it's going to play into it, but it should be there.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool, too, as you sort of uncover this even larger shared mythology between games. Getting away from that a little bit, I also never felt like I had to grind in order to complete the main plot.
Thank
anyway.
Goodness.
Right, like if you explored and you fought the available creatures as you went, like you were probably strong enough to beat whatever you had to at the time. So there were very few times I felt like I had to walk around looking for battles, and that was certainly to their credit, because Final Fantasy is a game known for its grinding.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was almost the charm of it back in the day. It was like, hey, grinding. And, you know, ain't nobody got time for that anymore.
That's right. And they did a good job of doing that. And if you want to, like, there is stuff later you can grind in order to go get, which we did, because we're sort of masochists that way. But we didn't have to, and that's to the game's credit. And let's see. Oh, and then there's a bunch of little mini items that don't really fit anywhere else that we really liked about the game, like stuff that made us smile. At one point, there's you go to this amusement park back on Cocoon called Nautilus. I think it was amusement park, and There's actually NPCs there you can talk to, and one of these guys, they've got these sheep you can pet that are like at this petting zoo, basically. And he's got this deep Teamster voice, and he goes, "Gotta love that fluff." And it's every
them
time
sheep
I,
gotta love that fluff.
Like, it's, who is that voice actor? Like, he, I don't know what he was going for, but he actually he totally nailed something, and it made me laugh every time I listened to it.
That's hilarious. Oh my gosh. Speaking of Nautilus, it felt so alive in Nautilus. You know, you walk by a Nautilus and every person is having their own separate conversation. Like, everybody you'd walk by. And they're just talking about something different. Like, oh, I, you know, I just petted the chocobos. Did you go? They're so cute. Oh, I love my outfit. Like, it was amazing. And just, I can't even imagine how much audio went into this game.
Yeah, just for that one scene. Because like I said, there's almost no NPCs in the game. But when you do go to a city, it feels like a city.
Yeah, it really does.
Which is pretty cool.
Wowza. Like, I was impressed.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it was super cool to see. Nautilus had one of the most amazing cutscenes.
Yeah.
That was the one with the fireworks where they put on the like history of the world or something.
Yeah,
right?
Like from their perspective, basically, like the legend of the war between Pulse and Cocoon, which had happened some time ago. Like, this is their version of it.
Yeah, and they just put this beautiful, beautiful cutscene on, and I was just—it was just one of those things where I. You know, I really wanted to understand what was going on and get into that cutscene because of the history.
Right, because, like, later you learn stuff and you're like, oh, like, that isn't the truth. That is Cocoon's version of what happened. Like, Pulse's version is totally different. Like, remember this cutscene? You're like, ah, nicely done.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. It's you know, victors are the ones who write history, right? There's a scene where Snow shows up. Our heroes are starting to come together and, you know, our team's coming together and Snow ends up getting the, well, we'll talk about the Eidolons, I guess, a little later.
Yeah, I think that's the name, like the big summons, Eidolons.
Everybody gets a big summon and Snow gets Shiva. And Shiva is so weird, just so weird. She's there are these two things that turn into a motorbike. It's, oh gosh, it's weird. And they merge together and stuff. But anyway, he comes charging in on this motorbike and he has ice magic. So he makes this big ice track and he just rolls in. He's like, oh, everyone, I originally had a plan. But since when does a hero need a plan? And like, it's just, like, everybody's about to get shot by Cocoon Police, and he just shows up like an idiot saying this line, and just, and I was just laughing. I was like, thank goodness for this sequence. Thank goodness.
Right, this is back when Snow is a total punk about being a hero, and it absolutely shows. I mean, he does save them, but, like,
yeah,
geez,
he
Snow.
Does, but just, oh my goodness, come on now. Okay, so everybody complains about this, but I just love lightning punching snow in the face. Like, everybody's whining. But, you know, I have this image of the directors being like, how much is our team not going to get together? Well, just make lightning punch everyone. It's like, Snow is just like, oh, I've got to save your sister. Boom, she hits him in the face. You know, I was just saying, boom, she hits him in the face. Love it, because he's such a tool, and I was so down.
Right, like, hitting people for no reason normally isn't good, but I really don't like Snow. So, I'm going to let it slide.
Hey, man, unless it's Snow, it's all good. I just found it entertaining. I'm sorry. So, as bad as that may sound, I found it funny. Okay, can we just talk about the most amazing cutscene?
The most amazing cutscene. It's not the history lesson.
Where inevitably we get back to Cocoon as part of the plot, and we're coming to the end, and the Cid of this game is trying to give a giant dramatic speech about humanity and civilization and all this stuff coming together during what appears to be a neuromancer cyberpunk NASCAR Tron race or something.
Yeah, that's the best way to describe it. It's certainly like a sports car sporting event that everyone's watching. So it's really not the good place to give that speech, but I guess he's limited for options.
Yeah, so it's just something happens to him. So he's really got limited time, and he's like, all right, well, I'm just going to give this speech now at NASCAR. And our heroes just bust in the middle of Tron NASCAR, and they're like, oh, yeah. And the police are like, oh, they're here, so let's shoot them. So all the police are shooting at us, and you know, everybody's fighting, and everybody's holding their own. And suddenly, Vanille is just getting hammered by bullets. She's in her Eidolon just, like, blocking. And then the camera swings around on the highway and zooms into Saz, like, on his face in this tiny, tiny car. Brunhilder is his Eidolon, and it transforms into a car, and this poor man is crushed in this tiny car, and the camera's zooming on him, and he's like in this thing going, you know, turning around, Vanille! And like zooms towards her, and I like was losing it. I was freaking losing it. I mean, Vanille's thing is a monster of a thing. And freaking Brunhilder, Vanille! And I was losing it.
It's like so overdramatic. And like,
it was
like
awesome.
I don't know what they were thinking with most of the summon designs, honestly.
The summon designs were so bizarre. Like, let's just have the craziest acid trip things we can think of.
Right, like, why does Ifrit turn into a car? Who knows? It looks cool.
Yeah, freaking Brunhilder.
Like, why is Shiva basically, like, you know, lesbian twin sisters that transform into a rideable bike? I don't know.
I don't even know, man. She was by far the weirdest. Like, Odin is like, I'm, you know, this guy who rides a pony, and, you know, Lightning can ride on the pony or whatever. Actually, he can transform into a horse, so he just, like, is a pony.
Because that's sort of, the summon was usually someone riding a horse. That's fine, I guess.
Bahamut is probably the least weird.
That's true. Bahamut's pretty...
Yeah, he looks about as crazy as he always looks. Alexander is the other one.
Yeah, big fortressy thing.
Alexander is just this, like, big robot thing.
Oh, man, he, like, you know, totally, I remember correctly, he totally channels, like, you know, early robot anime where it's, like, the kid with his watch, you know, yelling to his giant robot to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's like, Alexander! And he's sitting there on the shoulder of the robot as he moves. And you're like, wow, this is so, like, Iron Giant.
Yeah, this is like Tetsujin 28 happening up in here.
Yeah, it definitely looked cool and pretty back in the day. Yeah, so that was cool. I enjoyed that a lot. And then we come to the fact that, spoilers, in the end, the ladies' team is just the best. Just the best. So we were hitting the end, and I called you up, and I was just like, Scott, it's just all about the ladies, isn't it? And you were like, yep. I think it is. You know, you look at Snow, and he's like, oh, he's a tank. I'm going to use him a lot. And then later, Fang just becomes an unstoppable force. Like, there's no other way to describe it. An unstoppable force. She's just, like, a boss. She has massive attack power. She has massive, like, saboteur abilities. Like,
she's awesome all the time. And, like, Vanille is just a really, really good healer and also, like, saboteur. She's got all the best moves. And, you know, Lightning's, like, the main character. So she's basically good at everything. But she's especially good at being a dodge tank. Like, you can get her really high evade, and she can just step around most enemy attacks and still have enough hit points to take pretty decent hits as a sentinel role. So you're like, well, sorry, Snow, but, like, not being hit's better than being hit.
Yeah, exactly. So even when she's in Sentinel, she protects herself, and most of the time she doesn't even get hit when she's in Sentinel. So it's
Right. So you're like,
amazing.
geez, I'm sorry, like Saz, Snow, and Hope, but like you guys are gonna have to sit the final battle here
Yes, I'm
out.
sorry. Team ladies for the win. Yeah, I don't know if the game was geared that way or if they just didn't notice
Or
it
it's
was
just
going to
how we built them. Yeah, I
happen.
mean, if you didn't figure out that like Lightning could do the dodge thing, you probably would have kept Snow as a
Yeah,
tank.
maybe. That's true.
So, all right, so that's we liked plenty of stuff, but we didn't like everything.
Yes, this
So
is
I guess
true.
it's probably a good time to talk about, you know, they tried a lot of new things and not all of them worked out.
One of them would be the upgrade system. I'm going to let you take this one because all of your effort figured this out. Because I'm throwing it out there, I never would have figured this out. So thank you. I don't know if I said that, but thank you.
Yeah, like the upgrade system, it felt like a feature that was only like maybe half implemented. When you started the game, they said, hey, you're going to get items that are drops from monsters, and you can put them into your weapons to make them stronger, and they'll change things around. And I was like, okay, cool. So, like, certain items are going to give stats. None of that happens. They only do two things. It either gives you a multiplier on experience gain, or gives you experience for the weapon. Like, weapons can level up. And that's it. So, you've got tons of drops from all these different monsters, and they only do one of two things. You're like, what is the point of all of these drops? Just give us only two of them. I don't know, like there's supposed to be more here, I feel, and I just didn't get a chance to finish it.
Plus, like I was saying, I had no idea what was even going on. Like some of them, like you were saying, some of them were there, so you become multipliers, and then so you put them in there, and the next thing you put on, its ability to enhance the weapon is multiplied by all the other stuff you just put on before that.
Right, but it also immediately removes the multiplier once you do it. So, like, I guess the ideal thing to do is max out the multiplier, which I think was like 1.5 or times 2 or something, and then dump as much ex like high experience stuff in it once as you can to try to get it to level up. Because if you do things piecemeal or one at a time, you will never get anywhere.
Right, and then later on, any of that upper level stuff, if you blew it in advance, it was super expensive or impossible
Ugh.
to find. And I had to buy the multiplier I needed later
Yeah.
on because most of the drops were worthless.
Oh, there's never enough drops. So you have to go to the guy and you'd buy like Diablo horns or something, which were good for multipliers. Then you'd probably buy the other things that give you experience and just pump them all in. So you're just using money, which is a great segue onto there was never enough money in this
Oh
game.
my gosh, the money. It was just endlessly alms for the
Like
poor
they try to make
man.
it realistic, sort of, in the sense, you know, how realistic can it really be? But non-humans do not drop money. Like, they don't drop straight gil.
Right, yeah, that's right.
So they only drop items, and items sell for generally almost nothing.
Yes,
So you never really
yes.
had any gil, and there's no humans on, you know, Pulse at all. So there's no one to get gil from. And yet the store still has save points that function as shop terminals that are somehow connected to shops that are back on Cocoon. Like, there's a vague plot reasons why it works, but it still doesn't really work that well.
Right,
Like,
yeah.
if you're gonna go and make us isolated from Pulse, or from Cocoon, go whole hog. Like, I don't need a store at every save point. Make the crafting system work, right?
Right,
But
seriously.
instead, they kind of half did it, and nothing sells for enough gil, but you need gil to get anywhere. And, like, eventually you're just like, all right, you don't have any chance to experiment or try out different weapons, because, like, basically you pick one weapon, and you upgrade that weapon for that character. And if it's the wrong weapon and you screwed up, well, that's probably too bad, because at this point, it's, you know, 40 hours of gameplay worth of items that you've dumped into that weapon and you can't get them back.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It was really cruel. And they were like, "Oh, but wait a minute, you can
Oh no.
deconstruct a weapon and maybe get some stuff out of it, but you're never gonna know. You have no way to know what's gonna come out of there. So, what are you gonna do? Deconstruct it and then reset the game if you didn't get what you wanted?"
I actually did that at one point. Like, there was an item that I'd seen that turned into a ribbon, which is, of course, you know, in Final Fantasy terms, it prevents status effects, which is super useful for certain boss battles. And there was a high-level item that would, if deconstructed, maybe turn into a ribbon. But it took so much stuff to get that the one time it didn't turn into a ribbon, I was like, nope, I'm loading the game and trying again. Like, there's no way I'm building another thing to turn into a ribbon.
Right, you didn't have the time or the money. You know, there was another time that helped us believe it was a half-form system. The shop keeps evolving as you play the game, so you get more and more stuff
Yeah,
as
which,
you're
by the way, have pretty
playing.
cool theming. Like, whoever did the theming on those stores is pretty
Yeah,
nice.
it was really cool. The themes were awesome. But one of the stores is like a mineral store, sells things for like
Oh my
a
God.
million gil. Or like 1.5 million gil? Oh, no, I might be exaggerating, but it was a lot of gil.
There was this thing
gil.
Called like the, you know, whatever, the trapezohedron or something, like the highest level upgrade material. And it was something like 10 million gil, like sold at this, you know.
Oh, okay, so I'm not exaggerating.
Advanced then. Scientific reactors, whatever.
Yeah, I have no idea how you were ever supposed to obtain that much gil, ever, in the whole game.
I have no idea. Like, there was, and apparently there was one super high level creature that could drop it as a rare drop at like 1%. But again,
but
that's not what I'm playing this game
what?
For, is to try to grind a rare drop out of some super high level creature, or to find a way to get 10 million gil, which is essentially impossible. Like, I don't know, like, maybe people listening, like, you know, feel free to leave us a comment about how we're totally wrong and there is a way to go, you know, grind money, and we'll be really sad that we missed it, but we couldn't figure it out.
Right. Yeah, it was oh my gosh, that was so weird. Another thing that was a little rough, while I did talk about how cool the culture of Pulse is, you really had to get everything out of the seat stones, and while I did think that was a cool idea, I'm not going to go backwards, it does make the entire world of Pulse, it makes everything a ghost town. There's nobody to talk to, it's huge to run around in, and you're just like running around in these gigantor open fields, and I understand why people are sent to die here, and yeah, it's like a big, beautiful graveyard.
Right. Like, you know, human civilization has ended on the planet. So there's no one to talk to. There's really nothing to see. Like, you can see what's left of it, but that is it. And sometimes, I mean, as you explore the first time, your characters will say stuff to each other and comment on the areas, and it's really pretty cool. But if you stay there for an extended period of time, you know, you've eventually triggered all of those, and there's really nothing doing. Your characters will occasionally toss out a pre-recorded line, but it's pretty, you know, you kind of get isolated out there.
So I was really interested in what the Seath Stones have to say, so I dragged you along, Scott, in my ridiculous crusade to get them all. Late in the game, like I was saying, they're very, very difficult. It's oh my gosh. Like, the final boss battle, in reality, looks like paper mache compared to these Seath Stones.
Yeah, in classic Final Fantasy style, like, by the time you've beaten the baddest, you know, side boss, the regular boss is cake.
Right, so you're just like, oh my gosh. So we had to chug through this game. We put well over 100 hours right into this game, and this is where the grinding came out. So,
oh, goodness.
You just have to run around, Pulse, fighting everything, and you're building up these Crystarium points, is what they're called, to build different abilities, and the Crystarium becomes so expensive later on. It just,
yeah, they just like made the values increase, I think, way too fast. Like, at that point, you're just extending the game to extend the game. And I know it's all optional content, but they still don't have to make it this expensive to do. So eventually the two of us got, I found this one area with basically the highest concentration of XP, Mahabra or something?
Yeah, the Mahabra.
And we just ground through that area until we thought we were strong enough to take on some of these things, which was kind of boring.
Oh my gosh. I think I would actually sit and phone a friend, like call somebody while I just like mind-numbingly grinded my characters. Right. But it was unfortunately the most efficient way to go.
Yeah, like you could try to fight big bad bosses and get some XP, but those battles take a long time and require concentration, and also like for time spent don't really give enough XP, so the regular grind was kind of the way to do it.
Right, right. So here's the deal. If we talk about how much pretty much useless the upgrade system was, it wasn't nearly as useless as the items.
What
holy cow.
So
they give you items early in the game. It's a potion, so it works on everybody. So that was great in the beginning. You're like, oh, thank goodness, because your medic abilities aren't useful. And you're like, oh, okay, I really need this. And then, all of a sudden, really quick, items are totally worthless. Worthless. Like, you just get them and sell them?
Yeah, regular cure is so much more powerful than potion by, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours in. You'll never even bother. Like, Phoenix Downs are probably the only thing you're really in there for with the item command. And you also eventually get, you get this stuff called TP, which you can build up between battles, which lets you do special moves. And one of the ones you can get is to revive people through the TP system, which makes item command even more, like, vestigial. Like, is it just there because it's a Final Fantasy thing? I think, quite possibly, the most tragic item in the entire game was an accessory that would double the effectiveness
gosh,
of potions.
Right.
And you're just like, what, 200 health for everybody?
Like,
I'm dealing thousands of health and restoring with regular
cure.
What are you kidding
nonsense.
Me? So that probably should have gone away as soon as you were strong enough to never need it anymore. I don't even know why it was in there.
Not be in there to begin with. So anyway, something on the flip side that was super powerful and cool to look at sometimes, but wasn't all that useful, was the Eidolons. So you get them, and it's pretty difficult fights to get them, actually.
Yeah, they're like specialty fights where there's like a special objective you need to accomplish that sort of fits the Eidolon,
almost
which
like
is cool.
Pokemon. You can't really destroy them. You have to get them to a certain level of something using one of your abilities. And, you know, you had to like get them to accept you and then you could be chosen as their master. And holy wow, they were not good for a whole lot of stuff. Like, eventually Fang was dealing more damage than like 90% of the Eidolons I had. Fang. The win. But, you know, maybe Bahamut's super move did about what she did, but like, why would I build all that TP? It was just totally pointless. I just summoned them for the cutscenes.
I, like, there's actually some characters in my case that I don't even think I even summoned once, just because, like, they have to be the party leader to summon. And, like, certain characters aren't very good at being the party leader. Like, Hope is a bad party leader. So, I think I only saw Alexander once just because he's never my party leader. And so, like, I didn't use a lot of the summons, which is too bad because they look sweet.
They look
but
really
not,
cool.
Yeah, they're not that strong and they're not that useful. And TP is hard to build up and summoning takes, like, a lot of TP out of you.
It's a lot to spend on it and it's just not worth it. You're really just doing it because it looks cool. So that was a lot of effort for cool visuals. Saz was the other kind of tragedy, you know? I, to this day, have no idea what his whole deal was. Like, he gets separated with just Vanille, and he's pretty darn good because he's a great synergist. And for a long time, he's the only person that has haste. And freaking haste is worth its weight in gold.
So
you're just using him all the time to cast haste. But then later, Fang gets haste. And just, you know, Vanille gets haste. And you're just like, well, Saz, there goes your usefulness. Guess I'm never using you again. And I don't know what his role was. He never did that much damage. I don't really need a ranged character.
The game, like, you know, traditional Final Fantasy ranged characters do full damage from the back row, but there is no back row in Final Fantasy 13. So it's like they gave them the guns and had them do the less damage that normally means, but then forgot the part where there's no back row. So he just does less damage than everyone for no reason. Like, he's not as strong and there's no compensation for that.
Right. It was just such a strange character stat wise. And I read somewhere that at one point, if you leveled the correct gun, you know, magically, haha, if you knew how to level the right gun, you could get him to do a ton of combos. And by the way, those are automatic. It's not just like a button trigger. Like, you just had to hope that the combo worked. And one of his guns was supposed to be able to do a ton of combos in a row that did a lot of damage.
I can kind of picture that. If I remember correctly, like building up combo was like building up, it was like a damage multiplier, basically.
Yeah, that was the idea.
And it would let you break the enemy and do other neat stuff and so on. But there was, I think he had a special gun where he would never break the enemy, but the combo count would just keep going up. So I guess if you got it super high, you'd be doing like tons and tons of multiplied damage. But you know what? If your entire usefulness as a character is built on one gun, maybe it's time to rethink it, because I didn't get that gun.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I might have had that gun, but there was no way I could devote the time, energy, and money, put all that stuff into the gun.
Yeah, because it doesn't immediately sound useful on the surface. And you're like, you just keep having him doing what he's doing.
Right, exactly. Scott, do you remember those horrible things in the cave that murder you in one hit?
Oh, So there's this, you can do death as a spell, and it has like a percent chance of just, you'll do damage to you or kill you outright. But the problem is, in Final Fantasy 13, if you lose your party leader, it's game over instantly. And death might just kill you outright. So I didn't really feel like that was a good move on their part.
Yeah, and I also felt like death worked so much better for the enemy. I actually killed one of the Uber bosses using death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did. But I can't even tell you how many times I must have cast death. I just sat there spamming death with Vanille, spamming, and then protecting her with the other characters going, please work, please work. And, you know, those horrible things that we were talking about before, they have a slide move, so they'll knock you over, and it would take you forever to get back up, and they'd slide into you again, and you couldn't do anything till you got back up. And the other ones in the back were just spamming death. So you're just, like, falling over, trying to get up with no controls, and being spammed with death. So it was, oh gosh, it was a really poorly laid out area.
Right. Now, to the game's great credit, and I don't think I mentioned this back in the battle system stuff, if you lose a battle, it lets you just retry the battle immediately. You don't have to load from a save. And that is, like, the greatest.
Yes, that was awesome. So awesome.
Because first of all, you could experiment with your roles and run into a battle and find out, wow, that was the wrong move. But it's not hard to fix. So death is annoying, but it's not, like, cripplingly bad. If I had to go back a couple hours of progress because some guy randomly got off a lucky death, like, this game would have been almost unplayable in the last area.
Yeah, that would have just been really bad. Gosh, those horrible, horrible things. Yeah. Those bird things.
All right, so that's... I think that probably wraps up the stuff we didn't like, which isn't, you know, doesn't overwhelm the good stuff in the game, thankfully.
So let's, Scott, let's end by addressing the common hates of the game and just, you know, going through some comments about them. So you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you play more Final Fantasies than I have. And I think this was the most bipolar Final Fantasy ever.
Yeah, like, the only one I can think of that even comes close is Final Fantasy VIII, which you're usually in the I love it or I hate it camp. And this game, I think, was similar to that. Mm, like, it's pretty divisive.
Yeah, people really, you know, either like this one or just enraged about how bad it was. So, okay, so let's start with everybody's favorite, that the game is too linear. Yeah, the game's linear. Cocoon especially is very linear. You really have one path that you have to follow, and that's it. You're just kind of railroaded along to your next destination. So first of all, this works plot-wise. You're fugitives on the run, and if I were a fugitive and I had an open-world environment, that wouldn't make any sense. Just throwing that out there.
Right, it's like, you know, like Final Fantasy VII. Oh my god, Sephiroth's going to end the world. Go to the North Cave right now. Or, you know, maybe you want to go Chocobo Race for a while. Well, the game doesn't let you do anything else except escape, which I think works fairly well from a story perspective. So it was linear, but it had a good reason to be linear.
Right, exactly. And you got a sense you had to pay more attention to the paradigm shift mechanic. You'd be learning on the go. It felt like, you know, we were actually in danger and had to get somewhere. So there was a sense of urgency, and that was just built into that linearity. And yes, if you were looking for this massive open world experience, you know, you just got to wait till you get to Pulse.
Yeah, wait till you get to Pulse. Wow, that place is huge, and you can go anywhere you want.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no requirement where you go once you get there, which is a great way to highlight the differences between Cocoon and Pulse, like from a cultural kind of standpoint in terms of their different philosophies.
Yeah.
So I think it works there very well, too.
You know, there wasn't a whole lot of side quests on Cocoon. There really wasn't a whole lot of other stuff to do. It all rolls into the linearity discussion. But I was really down with that. And I don't know if anyone got to come to our presentation last year about bad games, and Dan had to sit through explaining Time and Eternity, this awful game where it was just like, side quests? Do you want all the side quests? It was so terrible. Like, these quests were just awful. Like, let's come up with the worst crap and give you all the stuff to do. And I was like, we're on a time-traveling mission to stop our marriage, you know, if one of us is getting murdered. But, you know, one little boy needs underwear, so
you're just padding the game now to say it's longer. Like, come on.
It's so bogus. So, yeah, you know, Cocoon, you're on the run. And on Pulse, like, nobody's bothering you. Everybody thinks you're dead.
Right, like, no one's after you, and you're trying to figure out what's up. The only person that has a sense of urgency is your characters, because eventually their focus is going to, you know, turn them into monsters.
Right, and I didn't really get to mention this earlier, but the main enemy is a really passively evil type of character. So when you're running around on Pulse, people are going to go against us and be like, well, what about the big bad guy who's supposed to be pushing the plot? You are a big sense of his evil plan, but he's playing this long wait game where he's manipulating you into doing what he needs. So you're getting stronger and stronger and stronger, and that just plays into his game.
Yeah, so he's like, take as much time as you want down there. Don't worry, when you decide to come back, I'll be here.
Right. Right, that's what he's doing, basically, and his whole plot has a slow weight to it. It all just functioned together.
Yeah, I think that was, again, like the choices they made in terms of how the game feels serve the story, which is, I think, good.
Right, right. Okay, so that covers linearity in our comments. So the second one would be there was way too much tutorial.
And yet, to some... It kind of did feel like the first, you know, the half of the game, the part that's on Cocoon does feel like a tutorial. They're introducing a lot of new concepts and having you try out new roles. So it's something of a tutorial, but it's also challenging you to try out new roles and experiment with different systems and the game's characters in ways that are going to be vital once you get down to Pulse. So
right.
A tutorial with a good purpose, I guess. And it doesn't, there's not too much hand-holding.
Also, you know, when you were saying earlier in the podcast that, like, Hope is a bad party leader, the reason we know that Hope is a bad party leader is because in the game, we're forced to use Hope as a party leader for a little while, and it won't let you switch. It's like, oh, you want to use a stronger character? Too bad. Here's Pope, and he's your party leader. Figure this out. And if you haven't really started to grasp a paradigm shift, you're just like, oh, whatever. I would just be the uber powerful character, have their spot as my leader, and I'll be fine. You'd be in trouble if that was your thought pattern. So you really have to think and reevaluate what you want to do. And when I'm stuck with this character as my leader, what am I gonna do? And, you know, later that helped me because in one of the really hard Seatstone battles, I made Vanille my party leader.
Oh, wow.
Someone you never would have thought would be a party leader.
Yeah, it's gotta be someone with big and big damage, but maybe the Saboteur is the right one.
Right, so you're sitting there, maybe she's the right one, and Vanille, I had to be able to control her Saboteur move, so that's why I picked her. So you get that time to experiment and play around without it being detrimental to you if you pick wrong. You don't get, you know, punished for it really bad. That was one of my biggest problems with Final Fantasy XII. The first time I played, I experimented a lot, and I paid for it so bad. I got so angry that I ended up dropping the game and had to pick it up years later because of how much they punished me. And so in 13, I got the chance to experiment. I got the chance to play around. I got that time because the game really forced me into scenarios I would not have encountered otherwise.
Yeah, definitely.
So yes, there's a lot of tutorial, but it has purpose, in my opinion.
Yeah. Another common one that we've heard, and I've heard this a lot, is, you know, we talked about this quite a bit, so we're only going to touch on it here, I think. I hate all the characters, or I hate this specific character, or I hate the way Lightning acts, or whatever. Like, as we'd said, this is a valid complaint at the start of the game. Like, every character in the game does have kind of a, I'll call it like a crippling flaw, like whether it's Hope being a punk all the time, or Lightning being a jerk, or Snow being Snow.
Yeah.
Like, seriously. It makes their character hard to like initially. But the whole arc of the game, since it's character-focused, is them overcoming these flaws and becoming better people. And because we're focused on that, it really feels like they develop realistically under the circumstances, which is to the game's great credit.
Yeah, most certainly. You know, I think this was a valid complaint in the beginning, but this was one of my biggest pet peeves. I would catch a lot of people in their own lie. These people would be like, oh, this game is so bad. Everything's so linear. And I was like, how long have you played the game? And they're like, well, I didn't play it at all. I played it for 3 hours.
But I read the reviews.
I read on a forum board that the game is really bad. So I decided that it's bad. And, you know, I was just like, really? All
right. Right. Like, I understand not everyone has a whole bunch of hours to play these things. But even by 10 hours in, you should probably start seeing the changes that they're trying to work with these characters. So anyway, if you got the patience, stick with it. They do develop well.
Yeah, seriously. So the battle system. So once again, they've changed Final Fantasy, and every time things changes, everybody's yelling, and all the fans are like, meh, 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 turn-based, 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 bring back
good old
stuff. And I hate turn-based, honestly. I jumped into RPGs really late, so I hate turn-based. I don't have any nostalgia for the turn-based stuff, but I know a lot of Final Fantasy fans are used to and really like, and This is very different. 13's very different. It's not turn-based. It's really not totally hack and slash. It's not like 10. It's not like 12. It's totally unique. You know, they got mad that this wasn't what they expected. Give it some time. It really gets cool.
Yeah, it was interesting, like, the complaint usually gets worded like, you know, why can't I control all of my characters? I can only control the main one. Or even then, I'm not really controlling them. I'm just telling them what I want to do. It's sort of the wave of anger that started with Final Fantasy XII's Gambit system, where you can kind of program your characters to do stuff. And it seems to just be cresting when it hit 13. But we had this reaction a little bit at the beginning, like, oh no, I want to be able to program every move into my characters. We very quickly learned to let that go as we realized what the game was trying to do. It's less about, do you cast fire or do you cast, like, ice at this specific moment? And it's more about, what's the overall desire I want you guys to have? Like, you still need to respond to what the enemy's doing. The game doesn't play itself, which is a common complaint I've heard. Instead, you're managing the battle at, like, one level up from where the characters are.
Right, like watching from a top-down type of perspective. I mean, you had to manage health, you need to know what your people are doing, and switching their paradigm, deck it around. You know, you really gotta think out what you're doing and what paradigms you're loading into the deck. And it was pivotal that you know, had a little bit of precognition about what's gonna happen and what you've encountered before. So I thought it was awesome the way they put that battle system together and how you really got a chance to strategize and play around.
So I think you have 6 slots, and like, it's never quite enough to do everything you ever think you could want. So you got to pick the best set, basically. It was good. And then I think one of the other cool things was like the AI on those characters. Like, it would have totally not worked if the AI and the characters you couldn't control was bad, but they did a good job on them. Like, as they cast, like, let's say an enemy is resistant to fire or whatever. Your guys come into the battle and you have never seen the creature before. They cast fire on it and, oh, it's fire resistant. They're not going to cast fire again. Like, they react in real time as they learn more information by casting stuff. And that's awesome.
Yeah, that was really cool. And you can cast Libra at the beginning. Pro tip, cast Libra. If you do that, your characters will be way smarter about battling.
Yeah, and that's where the game, like, that's where the programming really comes in. You feel like these are characters that they're smart enough that you can let them do their thing under 95% of the time, which is awesome.
Right, right. Yeah, so, you know, you really just had to calm down and try it out there. And I do want to toss it out that if you were a micromanager, you can go in and actually select every single thingamajig for your main character.
Yeah, the main character you're controlling, yeah.
You know, you could do that. You can stack, like, what, 5 abilities before you launch them out? So you can go pick those,
like,
one by one.
And every once in a while, like, there's a boss battle where you're like, I really need you to cast, like, poison 5 times in a row. And you can do that. Like, that's available to you. But most of the time, you don't need to.
Yeah, I think I did that a lot. And, you know, if you think you're gonna micromanage everything on top of it, watching everybody's health bars, stat bars, it's a lot to take in, so I like the way they designed it.
Yeah, I think they did a good job with it.
Okay, so, let's end with everybody's favorite. The plot doesn't make sense.
This one I do hear a lot, yep.
You had to read, I don't know what else to tell you, you had to read the data log, like, I know that probably crushes some of you from the inside out and blah, blah, it's not good storytelling, meh, 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 but you had to read the data log.
Right, if you just played the game straight, like, from the minute it started and never looked at anything else, all right, I'll agree. You're not really going to understand why some of the things are happening or who's coming after you or whatever, but it always tells you, hey, by the way, there's a little thing in your data log you might want to read because we don't have time to do it in the middle of this awesome action scene. And once you finally get the chance to sit down and read it, not only is it well-written and interesting, like, it's more information. They probably give you more information than you actually needed just because they're filling out the world, but you will understand what's going on.
Yeah, you have significantly better understanding of what's going on, and you have clues as to other characters' motivations, you get deeper understanding of the world, you get, you know, actually, if you went out and sought it, you got analects about the mythology, about the gods. There was a lot to explore in the data log, and you had to read it to get where you needed to go. And I personally just thought it was this cool add-on where I'm actually one of those weird people who, if I'm not given all the information I need, I can usually fill in the gaps, unless there's gaping plot holes. I can handle it, and I can fill stuff in. So some of the concepts, you know, like the fallacy are gods, and you're being chosen by God, you know, those upper level concepts, I just filled in gaps, and the data log just helped me along. So if you're somebody who needs everything spelled out, I don't think you're gonna get it. I will admit, you're not gonna get that. And so if that's detrimental to you, I can't argue with you. But for people who say there's no way to understand the plot, you can understand the plot.
Yeah, now, probably the strongest argument to be made here is that it breaks up the game's flow. Like, you know, okay, I don't want to go into the data log in the middle of every action sequence. All right, I will grant that. Maybe there's a better way to get across some of this information. But on the balance, I'm glad for all of the extra information that's in there that makes this world interesting. Maybe they'll work on integrating it better in the future, but I don't think it was a bad move, necessarily.
Agreed. Well, guys, that was pretty much our discussion of Final Fantasy XIII. We liked it. We recommend you give it a try,
yeah.
A real unbiased try. Don't totally give in to everything that's on the internet.
And give those characters a chance to develop.
Yeah, give everybody a chance. Read. Just take your time and drop us a comment if you played it. Did you like it? Did you not like it? We'd love to know. Tell us how to work around some stuff.
Or, you know, how to get all the money. Tell us where the money is.
Oh my gosh, tell us where all the money is. All the money. Oh my gosh, because seriously, all we were is poor. The whole freaking game. Oh, alms for the poor. All right, so to conclude, Fang is my home dog, Lightning is my other home dog, and the ladies' team for life. So thanks for listening. Check us out next time.
Yep.
This is a podcast by the Con Artists. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your Android podcast app of choice. For more anime and game-related content, please visit us online at theconartistsblog.com. Thanks for listening.